Welcome to the This Is Money podcast in partnership with NSNI, your weekly roundup of the top personal finance, consumer and business stories that editor Simon Lambert and his team have been covering on their award-winning website. I'm your host, Georgie Frost. Alongside Simon Nye is Deputy Knowledge and Product Editor Sarah Davidson. And this week, we talk death and taxes. With the recent property boom pulling more of us into the inheritance tax threshold, how can you make sure more of your money goes to your loved ones rather than the tax man? There's much focus at the moment on the financial generational divide. Speculation the Chancellor could use next month's budget to rob from the elderly and give to the poor young people. We look at the options and ask if this is the right way for the government to address the issue. Also today, could interest rates rise as inflation goes up again? What do you do with your old pound coins? And we've got 999, 111, 101. Is 555 the new number you need to know as the government looks to crack down on bank fraud? We head to This Is Money HQ for the very latest from Lee, the scam man Boyce. And my favourite story this year, we look at the Great British Service Station. All that and plenty more coming up. Don't forget you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, giving you 100% security backed by HM Treasury.
But first, you work hard all your life to build up savings, a pension, a nice home, and then you die. I'm sorry, but there is really nothing we can do about that one, I'm afraid. But there is something you can do to make sure your loved ones don't get lumped with a hefty inheritance tax bill unnecessarily. Now, Simon, you've been looking into this. Great article, by the way, from Tanya Jeffries. It is literally all in there. Anything you want to know about anything, it's in this article. But I have to ask you firstly, if only 5% of people actually leave estates large enough, why are we bothered about inheritance tax when most of us don't actually pay it?
Well, firstly, Georgie, I think that one of the reasons why people are bothered about it is because whilst 5% of people might pay it now, that number is set to rise. The OBR expects it to go up to 10% and keep going up. And one of the drivers behind that is your favourite thing, house prices, high house prices. And that goes some way to explaining why so many people are so bothered about this, because I think it's something where people are bothered geographically. So if you live in a certain part of the country and you live in a house of a certain size, then that's probably going to have pushed your estate up towards the inheritance tax limit or over it. But also I think it's to do with the fact that people work hard through their lives and they like the idea of being able to provide for their family. After that, they also see the younger members of their family facing a much tougher financial situation than they faced when they were the same age. So they want to try and pass some money on to them to give them a leg up in life. Now, critics of inheritance would tell you that that is deeply unfair and it entrenches wealth and privilege and things like that. But if you're going to be entirely honest, most people look at these things through the perspective of how am I going to help my family, not how am I going to help everybody else's families. And also, I think that the other key thing here is the level of the tax. 40% sounds like a lot. And people focus not on the fact that only above a certain threshold will they pay 40%. They focus on the 40% number. And so, yes, as you suggest, we are in a situation where we have a tax that is deeply, deeply, deeply unpopular and always draws lots of anger from our readers who complain about how unfair it is and how it should be abolished and everything else, despite the fact that only a minority of people actually pay it.
And as you say, there's a postcode lottery, but I do want to know what some of the options are. Sarah, welcome back. Lovely to have you here. Straight into it with what are the options to reduce inheritance tax bills unnecessarily? Because there are quite a few. We're going to start, I think, probably the one that most people think is gifting, first of all.
Sure. Well, the most obvious way to reduce your inheritance tax liability if you do go above that threshold is by giving away some of your money before you die. There are several complicated rules, according to HMRC, about how much you can give each year. Everyone has a £3,000 limit on the amount that they are allowed to gift to loved ones. Also, if you then die within that 7-year period, inheritance tax may be payable, and there's a sliding scale depending on how soon you die after you give that gift. But gifting is just one way of doing it. There's also giving money away to charity is tax-free. Giving to political parties is another thing you can do. And there are various ways to minimise your liability in terms of business property relief. So some kinds of investment, this is where it gets a lot more complicated, some kinds of investment will also bring your tax liability down.
This is all in this fantastic article by Tanya. My favourite one was farming.
Yeah, which
obviously,
is a completely...
What's farming got to do with it?
It's an arcane rule, actually, that goes back to when people were leaving agricultural estates in order not to break up farms, which work economically based on their size and the output that they can manage. If you had four or five children and they all inherited equally, then in order to pay the death duties on that, they might have to break up the farm. So it was really to avoid that from happening.
Amazing. Two famous ones, but possibly quite difficult to get your head around. There's life insurance. I should have mentioned pensions as well, but trust.
Trust.
Sounds really simple.
Well, it's not.
laugh is a very nervous laugh.
So trusts are basically just a legal structure. And if you're putting money into trust for your loved ones, it gives you a degree of control over when they can get access to that money. So it's the most simple kind of trust, a bare trust or an absolute trust, means that the beneficiaries won't get access to that money until they're 18. But it's still subject to the same tax rules as gifting, so that if you put money into a trust and then you die within the 7-year period, then the beneficiaries may have to pay tax on the gift that they've got through the trust. It's also, in terms of level of control, if you get the more complicated types of trust, you start getting into all sorts of nitty-gritty rules with HMRC, and it's really a good idea to get some legal advice if you're going to go down that route.
I imagine financial planning as well might be something you'd think about with all of these options.
Yeah, absolutely. Talking to an expert is definitely the right way to go, just so you don't get yourself tied up in knots.
I think what we need to talk about is just some of the basics of inheritance tax. So firstly, everybody has an inheritance tax-free allowance of £325,000. If you are a married couple or civil partners, you can also double up. So you can use your spouses. If they died before you, you can leave everything totally free of inheritance tax to your spouse or civil partner. Then on the second death, you can use their inheritance tax-free band. So it doubles up to £650. But you also have this new own home allowance that has been introduced by the government in stages. Now, this was a slightly insane system that David Cameron and George Osborne came up with, because initially they had promised in the Tory manifesto before the coalition government that they would raise the inheritance tax threshold to £1 million. When they came into power in the coalition, they had to ditch that £1 million, they said, because the Lib Dems had made them do it, but they wanted to bring it back in some way. And so the way that they came about of doing that, without being attacked for just favouring the rich, was to bring in this own home allowance, which added some extra money onto it. And by the time that's fully in, it will take the combined inheritance tax allowance for a married couple or civil partners who own their own home and pass it on to their direct descendants to £1 million. £650,000 of the standard inheritance tax allowance and £350,000 of this own home allowance, which is basically a ridiculously complicated way of raising the inheritance tax threshold to £1 million, disadvantages people who don't own property, disadvantages people who may not have direct descendants to leave the property to, and also there's another complicated bit where once you get £2 million, they start taking it back off you. Leaving that to one side, basically you've got £1 million. But there is an old saying that says that inheritance tax is a tax paid by people who don't trust their relatives. The single best way of avoiding inheritance tax on your estate is to give your money away. That's where the 7-year rule comes in. So if you live for 7 years after you've given something away, your money, another asset, then that becomes inheritance tax free. If you die within those 7 years, as Sarah explained earlier, then there is a sliding scale up to the standard inheritance tax of 40%. So if you're going to do some inheritance tax planning, it pays to think ahead. Obviously, you can't predict when you're going to die, but the sooner you start giving money away and the more money you can give away, leaving yourself as much as you need to survive on. You need to remember that bit. Because once you've given that money away, you can't have any control over it. You shouldn't really be able to access it. There's things to do with trust that we just talked about that means you can keep a certain amount of control as to what that person does with it, but it's not your money anymore. And also the difficulty is that you can't give away your house. Or you can give away your house, but then you would then have to pay rent to the person you've given it away to if you want to continue living in it, which is perfectly acceptable. But most people don't have the kind of income that allows them to start paying that level of rent,
and that also
potentially
makes
in retirement.
Them landlords, and then they are subject
to
other...
it starts to get very complicated. So all of these ways of avoiding inheritance tax get increasingly complicated, and the simplest one is to give your money away. But if you go see a financial planner, they will talk to you about inheritance tax planning, and they'll tell you the things they can prioritise.
I'm tired and exhausted just listening to you there, Simon. Sarah, should we just get rid of the whole thing altogether?
I think lots of people would be very happy if we did that.
What do you think?
Well, if you look at the amount of money that the government's raised in the past 5 years, it's $4.6 billion, which is, you know, not that much, really. It is a system that goes back many, many, many years. Persuading the government to give up any form of tax revenue is going to be a tricky one. But yeah, I mean, I can see there's an argument, given the rising house prices, especially in London and the South East, to say we should at least raise that threshold significantly more. I mean, average house prices in London for a first-time buyer is, you know, tipping £500,000. It's just disproportionate now.
Absolutely. Well, if rumours are to be believed, the Chancellor may inadvertently have his own solution for cutting your inheritance tax bill. Ensure you have less money when you die. Overlooked for too long in favour of the silver voters, could the Tories try to woo young people in next month's budget? Could it include measures to cut their tax bill, way to write off student debt, or measures to help them onto the housing ladder? Well, the money for this will have to come from somewhere. Speculation is a raid on pension tax relief. That's said to be back on the table again. Sarah, what are the options being mooted?
Well, they have not, as per usual, given us any kind of detail, but industry experts have come out and said, well, they could reduce the maximum tax relief available to higher rate taxpayers, so make a standard band at 20% so that everyone's getting tax relief at the same level. They could raise that from the 20% that basic rate taxpayers pay up to 30%, so kind of mid-level. They could start cutting the annual allowance again, or the lifetime allowance again. But the drawbacks to doing that is that, you know, if you think about bosses in companies who are agreeing how much companies contribute to their employees' pension schemes, you know, if their lifetime allowance is cut, there's no incentive for them to raise company contributions because they've hit their limit. And arguably, it's the lower paid workers who are going to suffer from that.
I also heard as well that the idea of taxing young people less than older people, and there's so many issues with that.
Absolutely, not least that people get older. So they might benefit when they're young, but they will definitely be penalised when they're older.
How on earth you can justify taxing a footballer, for example, who's in his 20s, less than you can someone who's on the minimum wage in their 50s. But anyway, Simon?
Well, actually, I don't think that is a bad idea.
All right, then go for it.
I think that a much better option than what's being talked about here in terms of hacking back at pension tax relief left, right and centre, and essentially basically coming up with ways to shuffle the deck chairs. I think that if what has been suggested so far happened, it would be absolutely disastrous. Hammond would shoot himself in the foot. There would be huge backlash against it. It would be very complicated. There's all kinds of things, like, for example, you'd probably have to get rid of salary sacrifice for pensions, because if you salary sacrifice your pension, you give up a certain amount of your salary, which then gets paid straight into your pension. Well, you'd then still continue to get higher rate tax relief by doing that. So you'd have a two-tier system where if your company did salary sacrifice, you'd get it, and if it didn't, you wouldn't. The comments on this article from our readers have been absolutely fuming about the idea of hitting them. There's all kinds of things, like lots of people suddenly pay more money into a pension later in their life because they realise they haven't paid enough in before. So do you then penalise them? That seems completely daft. However, cutting tax for people who are younger is a much easier system. You cut tax for under 30s, basic rate tax to 15%. Now, the reason why this is not a problem for footballers is not only because a lot of them probably don't pay
that's
any tax.
That's a good point.
The reason why this is not a problem for footballers is because you would only cut the basic rate of income tax to 15%. Most of your footballer's salary is not taxed at basic rate. The higher rate tax limit is 43,000 something pounds. And I think many Premier League footballers earn more than 43 something thousand pounds a week. So within a week, they're in the higher rate tax band. But it would give young people more money. It would also go some way to solving this issue of student debt. Well, not student debt, but the student loan payments. Now, I actually think that students should pay less money in tuition phase and come out of it with less debt. But if we're not going to do anything about that, then if you cut tax for the under 30s, it means that when they start working, yes, they're paying that 7% of their income above a certain level to go towards their loans, but they're only now paying 22% rather than previously having the 7% added onto the 20. But it also helps. It doesn't just help those students, because the argument against helping those students is, what about the builders? What about the bricklayers? What about the plumbers? Well, this helps the builders, the bricklayers, the plumbers, that everyone else. It basically helps all those people under 30 and says to them, here you go, here's a tax break. And then what you do is encourage them to try and save the money. I think it's a cleaner way of doing it. I'm not necessarily saying that I think we should do it, but I don't think it's a bad idea. And there are other countries in the world where younger people are taxed less.
But it doesn't address the fundamental problems. And back to my favourite topic of house prices and the like, and the issues with student debt and the problem with young people. Surely wouldn't it be better if we just took a look, well, one, take a look at why those problems are there and what we can do about solving them from a root level, but also just a massive overhaul of the tax system. Just go nuts.
Well, yeah, you're right. It's a sticking plaster on top of other problems. So what I'm saying there is basically, let's stick this as a sticking plaster over the problem of student debt, high house prices, people not being able to save enough into their pensions and everything else. So it would be better to actually properly tackle those issues one by one. But the reason why we can't properly tackle any of those issues one by one is because we keep coming up against this bumper that we don't have any money in order to do it. And going back to what I said before, rather than being willing to commit to a giveaway on certain things that we have decided are social goods or socially goods, such as people having affordable homes, getting better educations, having money into their pension, we just keep shuffling the deck chairs around.
If the Tories are doing this, surely, to woo young voters, do they not realise those young voters, touch wood, will grow up and will have to become pensioners themselves?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really important point. And I think we've looked at where they're going to take the money from in this potential gift to younger voters. But the things that they've said that they want the money to go to in order to woo those younger voters is student debt, writing that off, and measures to help them onto the housing ladder. And I think that if you think about the housing ladder, it's not just about help to buy and funding deposits for first-time buyers. Actually, there is a far more structural issue in the housing market in that there's not enough stock being sold and there are not enough new homes being built. Now, the new homes side of that equation is beginning to be addressed by the government. They've committed quite a lot of money and construction in the residential sector is going up. But in terms of existing stock in the housing market, it's not moving. It makes more financial sense for a family living in a home to extend that property than it does for them to pay the stamp duty it would cost in order to move to a bigger property. The same goes for older people who are living in these huge family homes as a couple, having seen all of their children move out. Now, if you gave a stamp duty holiday to the older people, you know, a downsizing incentive, which was actually floated in the very beginning of this year before the housing white paper came out and then didn't make an appearance. If you were to do that, that would encourage older people to move out of those big homes. It would make space for the families to move up into those homes. That would make more stock available at the bottom end of the market, which would help first-time buyers to purchase. So, I mean, I think there's more than one way to skin a cat here. And, you know, looking at taking money off old people is not necessarily the best way to do it.
I do think that one of the problems with the housing market is to do with cheap credit, low interest rates, not building enough homes, all these other things. But it's also to do with not enough people moving home. And one of the issues there is stamp duty. And although it's been changed so that people lower down the scale pay less and there's less of a cliff edge, the people further up the scale not moving does gum up the market. And there's been this idea of a stamp duty cut for first-time buyers to help them in London and the South East, where they're buying expensive homes, so they're paying 10, 12 grand on stamp duty. I had a conversation on Twitter about this with our friends at the Monovator blog this week, where there was the sort of the argument that you shouldn't be giving older people a stamp duty cut, you know, the baby boomers a stamp duty cut, who've made hundreds of thousands of pounds on their property. But I said it's not just about them. I think that there should be a stamp duty cut also for the people who the first-time buyers might be buying their homes off, and the people who might be buying the homes off the baby boomers. I mean, people like me, I am a perfect example of someone gumming up the housing market. I would quite like to move. I'd be quite interested in moving from our flat to a house. I'd probably do it speculatively. But there is absolutely no way I'm doing it because of the level of stamp duty I pay. If I pay that much stamp duty, I need to live in that house for at least 10 years and preferably my lifetime. So I'm staying put. And because I'm staying put, I'm not buying a house off someone else and I'm not selling my flat to someone else. And also the other thing on inheritance tax, when we mentioned earlier, I don't think we should get rid of inheritance tax, but I think we should cut it. 20% flat rate. I think people's problem with it is that it's 40%, and 40% is too big a number. And if you cut it to 20%, I think you'd have less people avoiding it, and you could cut the tax and still probably keep the same take.
So if you're listening, Chancellor Philip Hammond,
get your spreadsheet out.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, giving you 100% security, backed by HM Treasury.
Well, it's not just the government trying to part you from your hard-earned cash. 937,518 cases of bank fraud were recorded in the first half of the year alone. That's a combined loss to us of £366 million. Well, to crack down on this growing crime, ministers, police and financial chiefs, well, they've come up with a plan. Victims could be told to dial a new hotline, 555, model on the 999 emergency number. Now, it would alert banks to illegal money transfers and will help stop you losing your money. Well, direct from This Is Money HQ, delighted to say we can head over now to Lee, the scam man, Boyce. A very warm welcome to you, Lee.
Morning, Georgie.
Otherwise known as This Is Money Consumer Affairs Editor. But scam man sounds better. So tell us a little bit more about this, Lee.
Yeah, well, it's an interesting idea compared to what we've had in recent years, which is, it seems like this problem's been ignored at the moment. And when you think, as you rightly said, there's been almost a million cases of fraud in the first half of the year, you know, that's 5,000 cases per day. So what can people do when they fall victim to this? Well, what the government are saying now is that they're potentially thinking about doing a 555. So we have 999 for emergencies, 111 if you've got a non-life-threatening health problem. So this idea would be, you've fallen victim to fraud, 555, easy to remember, dial it straight away, and it will be like a central body that then can try and stop this fraud while it's in motion or get the right advice to you to potentially, hopefully, get your money back. Now, I've written a column about this today because I think it is an interesting idea. But what it can't be is that it can't be Action Fraud Part 2. So Action Fraud is a body that's out there at the moment that police, banks will tell you to contact if you fall victim to fraud, but it doesn't really do anything. It kind of just logs the case. It doesn't investigate, and I think a lot of people falsely believe that the fraud has been investigated, and that's exactly what this number couldn't be. So it's an interesting idea, but they've got to get it right. They've got to fund it properly. They've got to have the right level of staff there. They've got to have the right expertise. And there's I don't know if you watch this program, it's a bit of a tedious link, but last week there was a program with Trevor McDonald, which was an hour of Catch a Killer. So it was all about a golden hour of a murder investigation, yeah, in which police have 60 minutes after the murder that they say make or break 90% of cases, right? So the evidence is still fresh. Try and get people brought to justice. This is what this would need to be. It would need to be really fast-paced. And all I can imagine is, you know, when you phone up some of these numbers and it's like press 3 for this, press 5, you know, and you go through all of these options, get it passed from pillar to post. It just needs to be really kind of streamlined.
I'm wondering, Lee, if it's more about the fact of stopping people calling 999 than it is about a dedicated number that's actually going to significantly help people. I mean, you mentioned there you've got 111, you've got 999, you've also got 101, now you've got 555. It's very complicated. Yeah. Should really the first thing you do just call your bank?
That's what I would recommend, Georgia. I'd always say call your bank as soon as you think you've fallen victim to fraud, because at the end of the day, they could straight away try and put freezes on accounts. And that's what I'm trying to get at. This would need to be equal to that, or if not better. And you're right, you know, people probably do call 999 when they're falling victim to fraud, and they probably are getting quite a large swathe of people doing that. I'll give you an example, actually. There's a case I'm looking into at the moment from a reader. She's just fallen victim to a scam. She's lost a six-figure sum. She said the bank weren't really keen to do much. They told me to get in touch with the police. I got in touch with the police. They referred me to Action Fraud. Action Pool took a load of information down. They said that there's no guarantee that they're going to investigate and follow it up, and it could take 6 to 8 weeks just to decide whether or not they would investigate. That's a massive timeline for someone who's lost their life savings. So I think there needs to be a much shorter process. I think people need to know a timeline exactly of what's being done and when they can expect some sort of outcome from it. It's become a massive problem.
No, well, it has indeed. I mean, if you're talking there, over 900,000 cases of bank fraud in the first half of this year alone. You mentioned there about the case that you're covering at the moment, the lady not particularly happy with the bank's response. Are you hearing that quite a lot?
We are, and there's definitely some that are worse than the others. I won't name names, but there are definitely a few banks that seem to be really fobbing people off and almost using the mantra of, you know, it was your fault, you did this wrong, you did that wrong. And actually, in the large amount of cases that I get, you know, heartbreaking cases of people losing life savings, it's very difficult to tell them, well, it's all your fault. And in a large amount of these cases, I look at them and go, do you know what? Any average person would have fallen for that. These forces now are sophisticated. They've really sort of adapted in the last few years. And these are professional gangs that know how the processes work inside out. It's very difficult for people to differentiate who's a fraudster and who's from the bank.
What are some of the more popular or newer scams that you're seeing at the moment, Lee?
Well, definitely one of the bigger ones at the moment seems to be smishing, which is text message fraud. So you get a text message that looks like it's come from your bank. It comes through a genuine thread of messages that you've had from your bank before. So it looks realistic. It looks like it's come from the bank. You might then call that number, give over details on the phone, which you might not necessarily should, but people do. And from that bit of detail, fraudsters completely wipe out your account. This is the telephone fraud. People just phone up, brazenly saying that you've been a victim of, you know, have you made this transaction? No details, need to move your money into a safe account. That's been a very common one. And just a straightforward dodgy link on an email, opening an email and getting your online banking hacked and then getting it wiped out. There needs to be something to stop this tide of fraud and to start making inroads and cutting the amount of people that are getting defrauded this way.
It does indeed. And whether we get a 555 hotline or something else, these things tend to take quite a lot of time. And you are, at This Is Money, all about empowering people to do what they can to help themselves. So just, I know you've done this a million times before, but do it a million and one, because we can never hear this too many times. Give us some quick tips.
Well, definitely one thing I would say is treat all correspondence out of the blue from your bank with extreme caution. Text messages, emails, even letters. We've seen cases of fraudsters sending out letters in the post. If in doubt, just phone the number on the back of your bank card. If you've been contacted on the telephone, call them back on a different on your landline or on your mobile, because sometimes they can stay on the line. That is my number one tip. If it just doesn't smell right, go into branch or phone the number on the back of your card and find out actually what's going on. And just don't give out unnecessary details out over the phone. Just take a step back and really think a minute. Is your bank really going to phone you up and say you need to move this money into a safe account? They're not. What I would say is get onto thisismoney.co.uk/beat-the-scammers. And we've got a whole wealth of guides and all of the latest fraud attempts that are out there. Read that page. It only takes half an hour or so, and you can see all of the tricks that these fraudsters are up to.
OK, from 555 to another number associated with fraud, 19. For those of a certain era, you will remember the pop singer Paul Hardcastle. I imagine that you're a little bit young for that one, but that was his most famous song. But it seems even the famous aren't immune from scams. And it's not the fraudsters that got Paul up in arms, was it, Lee? But it was Santander. In steps, right. This Is Money. Take up the story for us, would you?
Yeah, so last month we were contacted by Mr. Hardcastle, and he basically had an account open for his son in the early 90s, and it had almost £3,000 left in this account. It was opened at Abbey National, which Santander took over, and Paul had the passbook. So he used to get you a little passbook, and it would show you what money you paid in, your interest, and any withdrawals you made. Now, fast forward to 10 years ago, they actually made a £5,000 withdrawal from the account to buy a new car for his son when he turned 18 and passed his driving test. Paul still had the passbook. That withdrawal was logged, and that's how it stayed until this December. So it's December 2016. They decided to take the rest of the money out. So it was just a shade under £3,000, and it had disappeared. There was no withdrawal out of the passbook. Paul's son was saying, I haven't touched this money. It had just disappeared. And not only that, he'd been removed as a trustee from the account. So Paul wanted to know how the money had disappeared and how he was removed as a trustee from the account. Something really didn't feel right. So he took them on. He asked for, you know, how was the money withdrawn? Because without the passbook, you can only withdraw £500 at a time. What had actually transpired is there had been one £500 withdrawal and one £2,400 withdrawal. So that was done without the passbook. So he wanted to know how that had been done. And Santander played a card, which a lot of banks do, is that because it was over 6 years old, they don't hold the record anymore. So they couldn't track down the signature. They didn't know how this money had been withdrawn. So Paul was really, really quite annoyed by all of that. And as he was saying to me all along, it's not about the money for him. It's about the principle. And he didn't like the thought of a big bank, somehow this money just disappearing. So what he did, and I love this. This is great. He issued a court judgment against Santander, which anyone can do. It gave them time to respond to, you know, his complaint, and they didn't. They didn't respond to the complaint. So he got in touch with us, and he was willing to put the bailiffs onto Santander head office. That's how strongly he felt about it. And the money was going to go to charity. He said that all along. He just wanted to donate the money to charity. He didn't want Santander to get away with it. So a month's passed. He gets back in touch with us. Santander relented, pulled a U-turn, and they've donated just over £3,000 to Teams Unite Fighting Cancer charity. So a good result in the end.
A good result, certainly.
Yeah, it's a worry to other people that this could have happened to, because, you know, lots of people have these legacy accounts that they've opened for children that they might not touch for a decade, more than a decade, because that's the whole idea. You trust the money to be safe in it. But for the money to disappear, Paul is adamant he's not taking the money out. He's adamant his son's not taking money out. And I'm going to believe him. At the end of the day, I find it very hard he would get in touch with us if he, you know, if he wasn't telling the truth. But there must be others out there that this has happened to. The money's just sort of vanished. And we still don't know fully how that money got withdrawn from the account. And it's one of those mysteries that I'm not sure we're ever going to find out what truly happened.
Now, Santander say they're not admitting culpability, are they?
That's right. I mean, they're just
saying
that it was the best way to resolve the dispute. And what I think that means is that they were a little bit worried that Paul was going to take the bailiffs to the head office. We would be taking some photos, you know, and it doesn't look good on them, does it? And for Santander to say, well, look, 6 years have passed, so we don't hold the records anymore. That's all well and good in certain types of account. But this is an old legacy account, even for a child that then turns into an adult. And realistically, some people might not look at those accounts for 15, 20 years. So that's a very difficult response to swallow, I think, to say, well, 6 years have passed, so there's nothing we can do.
It highlights to me, Lee, it's fantastic the work you do, but it's such a shame because, of course, you can only deal with one case. And you would have dealt with this whether he was a famous pop singer in the past or not.
Yeah.
But all of those other people that you can't help, it's so unfair for them.
It is. Oh, Georgie, don't. It makes me sort of so sad sometimes. I mean, I get an absolute flurry of emails about fraud and all types of different, you know, I need five of me to really deal with the avalanche of fraud cases that we've received here. And I try my hardest to cover as many as possible. But, you know, all I can say is keep getting in touch with us with any problems that you've got, and we will endeavour to, you know, trace your money back and hold these banks to account.
Brilliant. Lee Boyce from This Is Money HQ, thank you so much for joining us.
No worries at all.
This Is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, giving you 100% security, backed by HM Treasury.
It would be rather remiss of us not to talk about figures that came out this week. Inflation figures, unemployment, and it's all increased speculation that interest rates could rise next month. So, rising prices, falling unemployment.
So, this week, important economic news. Inflation up. It hit 3%. That was for September. It is expected to soon peak at about 3.1 or 3.2% and then come down as the effect of the pound's fall post-Brexit vote falls out of it. Barring any sudden fall in the pound, not expected to spike again. Unemployment. Good news there, fell by 52,000 in the 3 months to August to 1.4 million. That did keep the jobless rate unchanged at 4.3%. Slight bad news is that, of course, wages are not rising by as much as inflation. So they are up by 2.1% for total earnings, excluding bonuses. Unless you were a pensioner, of course, and then your income will rise by even more because it will go up by 3% because it is pegged to the inflation figure.
Thanks to the triple lock, right?
Yep, thanks to the triple lock.
Which last time I checked is still in place.
The last time we checked, the triple lock is still in place, and because earnings are not suddenly going to jump up and overtake inflation, basically it's going to be 3%. And the final piece of economic news that we need to know about is that everyone is now saying it's almost absolutely certain that the Bank of England is going to raise interest rates next month. So we shall see what happens, whether they do or whether this is just another one of Mark Carney's Maradona swerves.
Exactly. I did enjoy your blog this week, though. You did say that it's dangerous to predict when they might go up. And actually, you've said you've never been convinced by the arguments in the past. But this time, Simon.
If you ever get asked to commentate on anything financial, the last thing you should ever say is this time is different, because this time is never different. This time, I think, is different, though. I do think that they may actually rise. I think it's become as much about credibility as about inflation. In fact, raising interest rates won't do anything to inflation. I do think that they probably will go up. But then I don't think we're going to, at the start of a rate rise cycle where they keep going up and up and up. Mm. And really, it's not about the first move. It's about the moves after that. I don't think we're going to end up in a scenario like the US where we steadily keep raising them.
Sarah, can I ask you that while we don't expect them, if they do go up, to go up by very much over a long time either, what should we be doing to prepare ourselves for a rate rise? Because even though they haven't gone up, we've seen mortgages edge up, haven't we?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, there are a number of things that everyone should really be doing, regardless of whether or not interest rates go up in November. The first thing to say is actually expectations of a base rate rise push market interest rates up. Now, that is already having an effect on the cost of mortgages because markets expect them to go up sooner. So the cost of funding for banks who are financing home loans for the rest of us is already going up. And that's been reflected in the cost of mortgage products. Over the past 3 or 4 weeks, we've seen rates start to rise by a very, very small amount. Regardless of whether or not they go up more or they stay the same or they come down, which just incidentally, I think they probably will towards the end of the year because lenders' targets are coming to a close and they usually have a bit of a fire sale before Christmas, but don't count on that. But I think regardless of any of these kind of incremental changes in rate, there are some basic things that everyone should be doing. If you are on your lender's standard variable rate and paying around 4.5% on your mortgage, you should go and see a mortgage broker or have a look online and see what deals you could remortgage to. Apparently, there are about 3 million, it's an estimate, but generally agreed estimate, there are about 3 million people sitting on their lender's SVR, overpaying every month. And they could be saving hundreds of pounds in some cases. There are reasons why a lot of people don't remortgage. Maybe they are thinking about moving and they don't want to tie themselves into a new deal and then be hit with early repayment charges if they did decide to move. Maybe they feel like they won't be accepted by a mortgage lender. They might be on an interest-only loan. But I think it's important to note that actually over the past 12 months, lenders have made big strides towards helping people who are self-employed, who are paid through contract work, who maybe have had a credit hiccup in the past 12 months. There's a lot more choice and it's definitely worth going and having that conversation to try and save some money.
Well, if you want to save some money, stick your hand down the back of the sofa, your piggy bank. I'm talking about the old £1 coin. Don't leave it around. Yes, it may no longer be legal tender, but there's still around 400 million or something of them still out there. But what should you do, Sarah? What are the options?
Well, the good news is some places are still accepting them. Tesco has said that they will continue to accept round pound coins until Monday. You can give them to charity. There are various charities raising money. So Children in Need is doing a big campaign. All banks, building societies, the post office, they'll all still accept round pound coins and they'll exchange them for new ones.
Some get a bit sniffy, though. You have to have an account with them, don't they? So it's probably worth double checking.
Absolutely. And even if your bank and the post office says no, 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 you have the final option is to go to the Bank of England on Threadneedle Street and they will exchange your round pounds.
And why not? Good day out. Absolutely. So there are things you should do. Don't panic, but do probably get on with it.
Yeah, absolutely. Just going to say one last thing, which was if you've got brand new old pound coins, which is a bit of a tautology, they might actually end up being worth more than a pound. If you go on eBay, you can see how much they'll sell for.
I'm just impressed with tautology. You can come back.
Mm.
Simon?
We went on a bit of a mission last Saturday. Well, I say we went on a bit of a mission. My wife panicked, absolutely panicked at the removal of the old £1 coin. Decided that she should go around the house and find all the different places where there were old pound coins likely to be lurking. Children's piggy banks, mm-hmm. children's purses, things like
fun.
That. Drawers, in the car. There's loads in the car. You always find them in the car. And also, you notice the effects of inflation, because in the old days, you definitely wouldn't have left a pound coin lying anywhere. Yeah. And now you leave pound coins lying all over the place. They're not quite the new 5p, but they're probably the new 20p. So anyway,
how many did
we
you find?
Counted them up.
Yeah.
We got them out, sat down with my seven-year-old daughter. We counted them all up. £74.
No.
£74 worth. Now, bear in mind, quite a few of them will have come from
that
piggy banks.
Is,
yeah, I said this to people in the office. And they're like, £74? How did you have £74 in piggy banks? I was like, well, you've got to remember that she's seven, and every pound she's ever been given, we've never done anything with every pound she's ever been given, apart from occasionally raiding it to buy some milk or pay someone. So we probably owe her more than that. So we counted them all up. Took the kids down the bank, paid them into the banks. It was like a little bit of personal finance education as well.
Yeah.
But then that also led to the thing where there's a tin on the side in the kitchen, also has spare change put into it. So I thought, well, I better tip that up to check for old pound coins. Tipped it up to check for old pound coins. So there's 5p, there's 2p, there's 1p, there's 50p, there's 20p, there's euros, there's some American coins, there's some coins from countries that I'm not even sure I've ever visited, various things like that. And in there was the grand total of one old round pound coin. But having done it, we felt compelled to count it all up. So me and my daughter sat on the floor and did some even more maths and personal finance education, where we counted up all of the money and we got to £18.60.
It's a heartwarming
story. I know.
Story.
Oh, no, it's even better. We then bagged it up into individual bags. And I said to Ryan, do you know what I think we should do with this? She said, well, I said, I think we should take it to a charity shop and give it to charity. So we took it to a charity shop and gave it to charity. I must admit, when I first said that brilliant idea to her, she did look at me with a look that said, really? I was thinking that maybe you were going to tell me we'd spend it on sweets.
You can buy sweets from charity shops.
Yeah, but she was quite keen on the idea of the charity shop thing. Aww. So we took it there, and then she got four DVDs for £1 in return. Although we then discovered that two of those DVDs don't work. One of them is pirated. Someone's taken a pirated DVD to a charity shop. And the other one was from some region that doesn't work on UK DVD players. So there you go.
Oh, give bonding to experience.
Do give to charity, but do check their DVDs before you buy them.
The fun and games, yes, do. The fun and games you can have with a pound coin. I have to admit, though, I got really excited when I saw this next story that you had on your website. As regular listeners to the show will know, in my former life, I was a sports journalist, and it involved a heck of a lot of driving around the country. And after a long trip on the motorway, watching often some pretty dire football, generally in the pouring rain and cold, a service station seemed like an oasis. I admit not everyone feels so fondly towards them, but it seems I'm not the only one who's compiled a list of my favourites. I haven't written this down, I'd like to say, my list. It's just somewhere in my head. But someone has done some research somewhere and come up with the top 10 best service stations you would want to pull over into. Now, what I was slightly disappointed with this is, you two, some have got the north and south. I thought that was a little bit unfair. It's like watching University Challenge and having Oxford College against a university. It doesn't seem fair.
I think that the point you just made, though, is relevant. So I grew up in Scotland and have spent much of my life driving up and down the M6 and M74 to and from London and Edinburgh. So I've visited many, many, many service stations as well. And they're different. So my favourite is T-Bay, which is run by Westmorland. It's got a farm shop. And the southbound is completely different from the northbound. So I do think that it warrants a separate position. And equally, if you go to somewhere like Norton Keynes on the M6 toll, that's just one service station.
She's
for both sides.
Good, isn't she, Simon?
She's on fire. Oh. I know. Although you say that, but a little peek behind the scenes for our podcast listeners, for the regulars there. We do some planning for this.
What, you just don't throw it together and...
No. I mean, me and Georgie, you know we do some planning for this. You're involved in the planning. We have a conversation,
don't
we? Oh, I thought
you meant this article.
No.
Oh, well,
no,
yeah,
for this podcast. Yeah, tell them we do some planning.
Yeah, sorry.
Yes, so when our emails were going backwards and forwards about the stories we were going to talk about, there was a certain person who was phenomenally excited about the Best Service Stations article, i.e. Miss Georgie Frost. But we then had a discussion about the best services, and you told me that one of your favourites was Beaconsfield. Mm. And not only did I not say, what are you talking about? Don't be such a lunatic. Why have you got a favourite service station?
I said,
I love Beaconsfield. It's absolutely awesome. But the problem is, it's basically too close to London. So you've either not got far enough to stop, or you're close enough to home that you shouldn't really be stopping. I'm a big fan of Beaconsfield, to which you replied, no, some people have weaker bladders.
I said, not everyone has a bladder of steel like you, and not everyone lives in London.
But yes. We've got the full, look, go to thisismoney.co.uk/cars, because there is the full 112 strong list of service stations. So you can find your favourite and check where it is. And one which always has a fond memory for me is South Mimms Services, which anybody who knows their geography will be thinking, why is this idiot who just complained Beaconsfield was too close to London started talking about South Mimms, which is practically in London? Yeah. And that's because when I was a teenager, growing up in Hertfordshire, if we really completely run out of things to do about 1 o'clock in the morning, we used to drive to South Mimms to go for hot chocolate.
Oh, see? It's lovely. So my favourites are the Oxfordshire services on the M40, lovely water feature there, the Washington services on the A1, and Beaconsfield. Yes, because not everyone has a bladder of steel. And on that note, editor Simon Lambert, deputy knowledge and product editor to Sarah, for God's sake. And on that note, editor Simon Lambert and deputy knowledge and product editor Sarah Davidson. Now, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes and tell your friends and family and join in the conversation.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I. Giving you 100% security, backed by HM Treasury.